There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tech Magic, the podcast show where we journey to the heart of technology. I'm your host, Kathy Hackle. I'm a tech futurist and a gaming and tech executive, and I'm here to break down the latest innovations in tech, from fashion to space, to everything in between, including spiders. We talk about what might be a fad and what might be a future, and I'm usually joined by amazing co-hosts and amazing guests. And today, I have my amazing guest co-host, Lee Keebler, joining me back again. Lee, how you doing?
I'm tired. You thought I was going to say great. No, I'm tired. I'm in Texas right now. I'm in Houston. We're at the Augmented Enterprise Summit that starts tomorrow. It should start when this goes live, or maybe the day after. So I don't know, maybe some listeners are actually going to be at the conference. So come say hi.
Come say hi. That's interesting. And that one's focused mostly on the enterprise side.
Yeah, it's augmented. Yeah, right? AR and AR for enterprise solutions. So come see us at the Invisible Thread booth. We're hanging out. Let's
That's
get a
awesome.
Coffee.
Well, and I think Houston, it makes sense for you to be in Houston just because I think they've held it there before. Mm-hmm, and then there's like, you know, the oil and gas. Like there's a lot of industries in the enterprise side that have been using AR.
I feel like you should be here, though, because it's at the Houston Galleria, which I didn't know was like a mall. It's like Texas's largest mall. And so I walk out of the hotel and I'm in this mall and it's like Prada and Chanel and all of these high fashion brands that, you know, and I'm like, I'm not in the right place. I need to go find the Nike store in the Lids shop or something.
Well, I did many shopping trips to the Galleria, but you know, when I went to school in Texas in Austin, so we would go to Houston for shopping. So I'm glad you're there. I mean, I wish I was shopping for sure. I'm not. I'm actually back home in DC after an amazing week on the West Coast. I was at the Wall Street Journal Tech Live event. I mean, it was like, yeah, it was amazing. Like Sam Altman from OpenAI was there. Like, oh my gosh, everyone was there.
What was
like,
the best thing? What was the best thing you had as a takeaway from that?
The best thing I had from it? I mean, I feel like almost every panel was about AI. Mm-hmm. And the conversation about AI, I think for generative AI, has just taken over the headlines. And I feel like people are really excited about it, but they're not connecting. They're not connecting different technology trends together, like this convergence that you and I have talked about a lot. Mm-hmm. So like they had the word, like they had like a couple spatial computing questions that came up. And I feel like everyone thinks spatial computing is only VR and AR. And I'm like, no, y'all, like I'm working on making sure that people understand it's a lot broader. So one of my biggest takeaways is, yes, I think the tech world is obviously obsessed with generative AI, and rightfully so, because, you know, it's definitely changed a lot of things. But I feel like we're not having a broader conversation about the convergence of technologies. But other than that, it was a great event. I mean, it was a great event. A lot of people there. This is what was interesting. A lot of talk about, you know, techno-optimism and techno-utopia around the tech crowd, which I found interesting. You know,
What does that look like, though? Like, because everyone... This is where you get the dystopia conversation, because mm-hmm. if everyone has their version of a utopia, no one's no definition of a utopia, right, is synonymous for all parties, right? If it's a utopia for one person, it's a dystopia for another person somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
So how do you do that? What's that balance look like when you've got a bunch of like-minded individuals who are all focusing in like this narrow field of technology?
I think for all those of us that work in tech, right? Like I said, we've been deep in the, you know, in tech space. I feel like we tend to be siloed and we put like blinders in some sort. So the conversation around this type of AI utopia is usually like, oh, it's going to solve all cancers or it's going to lead to more opportunities. But we still have to talk about, you know, the potential issues of things that could go wrong. And because you talk about something that could go wrong doesn't mean that you don't believe in the technology or that you don't believe in the power for it to change lives. But you have to be realistic that there are potential dangers, right? There are potential issues. This is interesting. Your question is really interesting because it comes at a time when just last week, Marc Andreessen, you know, published this manifesto. I'm not sure if you saw it at all, on his techno-optimism manifesto. And it's been making the rounds definitely in the tech space and a lot of commentary. I don't know if you remember a couple years ago, he had written about software's eating the world and that kind of bred a lot of conversation. This manifesto is a little bit different because it's very much in the line of what's called effective accelerationism, which is kind of the idea and the concept that we need to move forward with technology without any type of you know, deacceleration. So it's a complicated matter. Like, I don't feel like we should get into it today. Maybe you and I can have a conversation about it in the next episode because it's really split the technology space.
I definitely think that's an episode because I've got so many questions and we do not have a time. we have a different run sheet of things that we wanted to talk about today, but now you've piqued my interest.
Well, yeah, I think you should definitely read it and we could have a conversation about it because definitely in the tech space, this manifesto from Andreessen has really split people like between, you know, the visions that he presents there and how powerful he is as a VC in the tech space and in the tech space in general as a multi-billionaire. But also people that are like, well, it doesn't mean that because I think that there is some issue with some of these technologies or that we should regulate them, that I am kind of wanting this not to happen. So yeah, I think there's some tension. There's some tension in the tech industry on visions of what this techno-optimism could look like, but still very interesting to dig in. On the note of optimism, I will tell you, I had a fantastic weekend. I have my parents in town and I'm very lucky to have them here visiting. And I took them to two different concerts for Latin artists. So some people might not know them, but Luis Miguel, who's like a very famous Mexican artist, and then Carlos Vives, who's a very famous Colombian artist that, you know, made some type of regional Colombian music very popular. And it was just super fun. Like it was fun to go to a live event and enjoy the music and have the experience. I will tell you, and I never noticed this before at the Luis Miguel concert, I was kind of on the side, great seats, but I could see the singer and he was singing from a teleprompter. I've never noticed that before in my life at any other concert. Do you know, like, do artists use teleprompters? I was like, yeah. Is this really expensive karaoke? Like,
for those who know me, my background, I've done my fair share of tours with a number of artists, as a musician, or sometimes just as a tech. And it's more common than you think. When you start getting into really large, catalogs of music, like, you couldn't expect Tony Bennett to remember every song he, like, you know what I mean? Like, sometimes you just get into these huge catalogs and you go to certain areas. And if you have really good booking coordination, you know that like certain music does better, like certain songs were a hit here, you know, or what demographic you're probably going to get a larger group of people for. So sometimes it's used for that, for those kind of deeper cuts that you might not remember all the words for. But those screens are also there prevalently. I've never done a show without a screen there because it has a clock on it. So that's also being like, yo, this is how much time they paid for. This is the stage you're on, you know, because it's just so involved about licensing rights and things like that of like where you're playing and the venue and all that. So most of those also contain a clock. So I don't know. I've seen it used for both.
It was interesting because I've never seen a teleprompter. I mean, I come from, like, I studied journalism in school and I was on TV for a while. I was like, oh my gosh, he's using a prompter. This feels like really expensive karaoke. But he does have, you know, like more than, I think, 20, 30 years of music, a music catalog that's immense. So I could understand why that would happen. So this actually leads us perfectly into the first story that we're going to discuss, whether it's fad or future, and it's kind of what's happening in the music industry specifically. And this is your world, right? Mm-hmm. Around artificial intelligence, right? The latest news was Universal Music Group suing Anthropic for use of music lyrics, right? Some people, you could write into one of their LLMs, into Claude, you know, questions about a certain song, and it would spit back lyrics. So there's like a lot of stuff happening here in the music space. You know, lots of different lawsuits, both from, you know, authors that, you know, whose books, you know, who are suing, you know, whether it's OpenAI or different platforms, because they feel like, you know, some of the language models have been trained with their books. In this case, it was music and lyrics specifically, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts? I mean, this is your world, like fashion's my space.
Yeah.
From a music perspective, what do you think of this move?
I've got, well, you want to know my honest answer won't make the labels that I've worked with happy, but I think that I think they're splitting hairs because someone has to make the argument first. Really, that's what it boils down to, is if you can make the argument first and confuse enough people to win, it becomes your win for the rest of time. Then it takes like an act of Congress to actually like change a law to like undo some of this stuff. So there's this need to set precedents early when it comes to any legal case that's never been proven. And hands down, that's exactly what's happening right now. Does anyone actually care if you can look up lyrics through an AI tool other than Google? I mean, I probably not. I'm sure somebody does. And someone's listening who's like, I'm a scab now. But like at the end of the day, that's just not, as a songwriter who has major writing credits, you can go look up my discography and figure out who I'm talking about. I don't care. Mm-hmm. And I'm the one who should, because I am the songwriter. But it's a need to set this precedence. The reason why I think this is a little bit of a reach is how many songs are like, go back to like listening through songs from the 1950s, and how many songs are the same blues riff with a different drum backing and slightly changed yeah, yeah, yeah lyrics about your girlfriend, yeah, 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 hold my hand, yeah, yeah, yeah. This is, how many songs are about doing the twist, right? Like, let's just take something very, very narrow.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, you had Chubby Checkers, and then you had Twist again. It just keeps going and going and going, right? And Twist and Shout. You know, it just keeps going and going. So these derivative works, and there is an argument about derivative works where a derivative work does have copyright protection, but it only protects the copyright of the part of the work that was the originating. And then the work afterwards is a new copyright. Right. So that's just kind of like a bit of very boring legalese copyright 101. What I read through the articles, and I have my own questions of what it means to scrape and where is that data being held, I guess is kind of in there. But I grew up when I was in seventh, eighth, let's say ninth, 10th grade, mm-hmm. and I'm learning to play the guitar and I'm online downloading guitar tabs to learn how to play my favorite Blink 182 song. Just to date myself a little bit here.
Yeah.
Whose new album
I'm again, by the way.
So psyched for that, but that's a whole other conversation. As I was doing that, no one cared where these poorly written most of these guitar tablature websites weren't even accurate, or the words are slightly off.
Yeah.
So this isn't new. It's just a new tool that's doing it. And so really this goes back to what I was saying. It's like, everyone is making an initial grab at settling a precedent so that it works in their benefit. Of course, it's going to be the major labels. If anyone thinks that it's the artist doing it, most of the artists don't even write these lyrics. So that's not them. And it's not really the songwriters like myself, because no one emailed me. So I had nothing to say with it. This is a precedent grab.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting that it's the label, right, that is the one suing.
Oh, that totally makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's interesting, though. It's like you said, it's not the artist. It's not the songwriter. It's the label, right? Because at the end of the day, for the label, their client is the artist, right? Like, their ultimate client is, like, who's their ultimate client? Like, give us the, you know, give us the specialty. I mean,
their ultimate client is who's ever going to pay them for the license. It's not the artist. The client, the artist is the product.
That's a good point.
The artist is a human resource, right? Like, they're just out there mining.
It could very well be an AI. Like, they don't care as long as someone's going to pay for it, right?
And that's been proven, right? We've seen labels experiment with the idea of what does an AI-driven artist look like. Okay. Mm-hmm. And now this does start getting interesting when those AI-driven artists start mimicking, and this goes to a different article that you sent later, right? Those AI artists start mimicking real people. Mm-hmm. And so now all of a sudden now you're getting into territory where the artist will care, the songwriter will care. So I don't know. I think I'm not surprised by any of it. Mm-hmm. I think precedent will get set one way or the other, and it will all get challenged for the next 5-10 years. And really what it's going to boil down to is better content ID. This gets very nerdy very quickly. Just better, for lack of a better term, but like better metadata on what, where this content's coming from, and how it's getting utilized. Because there's an argument to be said that an AI could have, because as a musician, I can cover any song that I want, right? I could go and cover the entire Beatles discography if I'm willing to pay, I think it's the Harry Fox Agency still, but like the residual right to that, which I think is like 10 cents per the sale or something like that. So technically an AI could do that and they're done. Okay, that's fine. But that hasn't been challenged. It's just so Wild West right now. And that's the best place for the entertainment industry to be. Mm-hmm. Because that's where you get really creative new work.
Innovation, like real creative work, real innovation. I mean, it's really interesting to see what's going to come off of this. I will tell you, like, just having had these back-to-back live music experiences, and we're going to get into that because I was at the Sphere. But, you know, having back-to-back, like, live music experiences, I love just being around all these people, having a great time singing. So, like, in my mind, when I'm going through these concerts, I'm like, you know, like right now, like as a human right now, like nothing replaces this. Like even when I do virtual, like go to virtual concerts in VR, I have a great time and I enjoy it. And I've had a fantastic time in VR concerts, but I was there. Like I was hugging my dad. Like I was dancing with my dad. I was like there with my best friend. Like it was just, I don't know. And the vibe, the energy of just like the live experience. I don't know. We're still humans.
This goes to my most bitter argument about AI. Like, and it is, why in the world are we trying to leverage this amazing technology to replace things that we actually enjoy?
Yeah.
Good point. I forever will not understand humanity for this being the starting point. The fact that we took this and we're like, we're going to replace artists. Why? People like being artists. They like creating these things. We're going to replace writers. Why? People like writing stories. That's part of the human experience in general. If you want to do something useful, go replace my tax accountant.
That is so true. Oh my gosh. I love Brittany. I do love you. I don't want Brittany to be replaced. She's my tax accountant. but yeah, you know, I definitely agree. Like there is something magical about that artist being a human. And even for like a perspective of like, you know, like Luis Miguel, like women love him. They're like in love with him. Like my mom, like I took her because my mom loves this artist, right? And like there's would she feel the same if it was an AI hologram up there? Like, I don't know.
I don't think so. And I think this is why I'm not too worried about it replacing the artistry of it all is because what makes art is the flaws. And as that continues to get ironed out, like it's the purposeful flaws. They use this combination of language to speak to me about a life experience that resonates as opposed to a computer.
I'm not sure you can relate to heartbreak in the way that, you know, that someone does. So that kind of bleeds really well into, you know, kind of like live performances, kind of what's happening in the space. music, tech, gaming all kind of come together. So
it's all the same thing. I've been saying for ages that video games have turned into performances.
100%.
I get the weirdest eyebrow raises when I'm talking to like OG guys who've been in this industry for a long time. And they're like, what do you mean video games are performance? I was like, well, define a performance, then define a video game and realize that video games don't just sit on a shelf. Right. Like these are persistent experiences that you go with other people. And after I get off my soapbox, I at least have a handful of converts. They're like, whoa, video games are a performance now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. They really are. It's a wild thing to think about, but it's going to take a lot of negotiation and litigation and creating new precedents, all boring legal arguments that I find interesting.
So is it future or fad, like in your perspective? Like for me, I feel like these lawsuits will continue to continue. It's a bit of a fad, but it's a big part of the future, right? Because these, they're going to inform what happens in the future. So I'm kind of torn in between future and fad here.
I think this is our future for a while. I think these legal art, because ultimately what it's doing is it's staving off the demise of the major labels. And I don't know if there's a world where that's just not inevitable. It's just about how long can they prolong that from happening. And that's going in until they're gone. We're going to continue to see lawsuits after lawsuits because that's ultimately what these major labels do. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I've worked with major labels that I've adored. Yeah. But the slow growth of the indie music creative tools are getting a lot more easy to use. Most major songs were created on a MacBook Pro. The MacBook Pro is more important piece of studio gear than any audio equipment in any major recording studio in the world.
Whoa, that's a big statement right there, Lee.
It's true. Like the MacBook Pro has done more for the music industry in any other piece of tech in the last 20 years.
Whew, that's a big statement. I'm sure if we're going to get some emails about that, maybe.
That's we'll see. Fine. You can find me.
So moving from that into live performances and kind of what's happening at another one of the world's biggest stages in the world, the Sphere, right? And I'll kind of just give everyone a little bit of information on why we're going to talk about the Sphere beyond the fact that it launched. This past weekend, it was TwitchCon in Las Vegas. Thousands of people were in town for TwitchCon. The giant sphere, which is a spherical structure that's been built in Vegas, there's going to be others built around the world, had actually ads for Xbox. And it was Xbox and Sony. So Xbox and PlayStation put out ads, giant ads, because this is a giant spherical structure during TwitchCon, because all the gamers were in town. And it was really exciting to see that. Like, I was at the Sphere, as you know. Mm-hmm. Leave for opening day, and U2 is performing there. What do you think of like these studios using this as an advertising platform? I mean,
I think that's exactly what it was created to do. Mm-hmm. It's a massive LED. You can't say billboard because not flat. It's a sphere. It's a massive
sphere,
LED,
right? It's
sphere.
A spherical structure. So
I think that I've seen it be used for really creative, interesting art. But if anyone thought that it wasn't going to be used as an advertising device, then they're just way more optimistic than I am. I'm not even saying it's a bad thing. I saw the Xbox logo looked incredible because it fits to the sphere shape. It totally makes sense. You know, you got a bunch of logos that fit into that design I'm not at all surprised to see it. And especially when it connects to something like TwitchCon or something like that, where it just makes logical sense. I think we're going to see that over and over and over again. That's got to be baked into the business acumen of the actual location, I would think.
Well, I think with the Formula One race, you're going to see things there like CES, which happens in Vegas in January. You're going to see things on the sphere. All eyes are on the sphere right now. So very smart, I think, for them to use it as an advertising, you know.
So I haven't been to Vegas since it opened. So I don't know from a strip perspective what the impact is. But you have, like, what is the visibility of the sphere from anywhere. I'm sure from an airplane it looks incredible, but when you're like in Vegas proper and yeah. you're on the strip and you're like over by Bally's or a Harrah's mm-hmm. Casino or something like that, is there just this looming neon sun in the background just glowing in the
horizon? It depends on where you are on the strip, right? It depends where you are. Like, because this is really close to the Venetian and Palazzo. Mm-hmm. You can actually walk. There's like a walkway to get there. So I wouldn't say like if you're on the strip, you would see it. It depends. But it is pretty visible. Like if you're in an Uber driving somewhere, you're going to see it. It's pretty massive. And I feel like it's even become a tourist destination of sorts.
Oh, totally.
Like people will walk to see the sphere, right? So that's another thing.
I feel bad for whoever gets like the sphere side of the hotel's like room. They pay for some high rise and they're like, wow, yeah. these blackout curtains are just not strong enough for this big old glowing eyeball.
But you know what? I think people are asking for those rooms. They want the rooms where you can see the sphere, right? Because the sphere is a show in and of itself, right? It's a performance.
So, that's true. That's true. Inside and out. Inside,
right? Yeah, so, yeah. So I think like I was disappointed when I checked into my hotel room and I couldn't see the sphere. I was like, oh, well, I'm going to go anyway, you know, but yeah, I was like, okay, I got a view of the other side. But anyway, but the venue per se has, you know, captured the headlines. A lot of people talking about it because it is a giant sphere. It has right. amazing audio. It has about, I think 10,000 of the seats have haptics and different kind of elements.
Oh, I didn't know about that. That's interesting.
Yeah. And the sound is amazing. I mean, the visuals, you and me, like we're probably, it takes a lot to impress us at mm-hmm. this point. I literally, during one of the U2's performances, I literally almost cried because the content, pretty much the sphere started to get filled with code and then it expanded and went all the way up to the top. And then, I don't know, it just seemed beautiful. It seemed like a virtual experience coming into the physical world in a way I've never seen without having to wear a device. And this was happening in front of me, right? And for me, it was an interesting experience because a lot of people were there for the sphere, for the venue. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were there because it was U2, right? A lot of big fans. But there were certain moments during U2's performance that they were not the attraction. It was the venue.
That was my question, is like when you get an ego like Bono in there and who's like, you know what I mean? Like that's the front man of all front men. And all of a sudden you're outplayed by the venue itself. I do wonder what happens emotionally in that moment for the artist.
Well, I think they know. I think that they know because they balanced the performance and like the songs were tied to different things on the screens, right? Mm-hmm. And some of them took full advantage of the spherical structure and the technological capacity that this venue has. And at other times, it literally was very subdued. There was a part where it was very barely any use of the screens, right? So I think that it was a good balance from overwhelming everyone with the technology, which is what I would have loved to have seen, right? Because I'm mm-hmm. like, I'm good for that. But most people would have been like, this is too much. And balancing it. So I think that other stars that are going to show up. And by the way, U2 just extended. They extended to a couple more shows. Yeah. So that's really exciting. But I think more artists, when they come, they're going to have to play and find that balance between I am the singer that you're coming to see with this is the technology that can at times be really exciting, could be overwhelming for certain people. But yeah, I mean, it's a one of a kind, very expensive venue.
It's got to be expensive to program for. So is there a life after performance, right? Does that content get to go live somewhere virtually where other people get, or is it just, it's burnt, it goes into an archive and you're done, you know?
Well, I hope it does go somewhere because some of these effects are like this, the experience of being there. I don't know how to like,
what I'm thinking because I'm seeing the move of like where augmented reality is going. And I'm like, this is content that you can repurpose and take home with you. Right.
You could eventually maybe put it in, use the Vision Pro, like find a way to put it in your living room and have the experience. When I was in there, because it's a sphere, I kept thinking about the, you know, the 360 cameras. Do you remember the Nokia one that was like round one, like very $30,000 back in the day? I don't know how, it was really expensive camera. And it was round and it had all the cameras and everything. And I felt like in some ways, if I was sitting in the middle of that venue, if I were that camera, I could capture this experience in a way that would just make sense. I don't know how to explain it.
That does make sense. I remember that camera. So yeah.
Yeah.
But all that content's there. My Quest 3 came in and I was playing with the AR demo that like shipped with it. And it was mind-blowingly good. It does such a good job of like curating the experience to your surroundings in a way that I was beyond even my own imagination. And as someone who's been in this industry for a long time, so I'm thinking of like the Sphere content and now really understanding like, yeah, you could take like 180 degrees of that in a Vision Pro and have an experience that I think people would actually pay for. When they go home, right? Because you can't take
Once it's over, it's over. It's going to be over because there's lots of other. I'm sure there's a long list of artists trying to get in there. Like this is the all eyes are on the Sphere. So to that point, fatter future. What's your take?
Oh, it's so hard. I said earlier that Vegas is fadulous because they just are like fad in Vegas. Like they just pump through the fad. I think if they can find a way, like you said, the content does turn off, but maybe there's like a repurpose for it. I think that drives it towards future. Otherwise, it's just a very unique destination location, which totally viable, but I think big. And sometimes big means small.
Yes. No, I agree. I'm with you. I feel it's future. Like it might seem like a fad to some people, but having been there and experienced it myself, I said there's something special here. This is a different type of venue. This is a different type of experience. There's a premium definitely assigned to that type of experience.
I think Vegas in general, I think is having a hard time keeping younger people going to Vegas. Mm-hmm. If you've got a very set group that returns, right? Your return customer, do they go every time?
Depends on the artist.
Right.
If you have Taylor Swift and then you have Harry Styles and then you have Beyonce and then you have like all these like, you know, if you look at the economics of Taylor Swift, like if they do something
Taylor
like
Swift
that,
can do a performance on a moon, people are going to figure out how to get there. Like that, it doesn't matter you do.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. So I think, you know, from a younger perspective, like bringing like F1, you know, Formula One, like I think they're trying to do things to appeal to a younger audience. I think, you know, starting to see more hotels that do not have casinos and are not like are non-smoking, another way to attract, you know, generation that might not be interested in some of that.
Is there a casino attached to the Sphere?
Well, the Venetian and the Palazzo.
Yeah, but not in the actual Sphere building.
But not
itself.
In the actual Sphere. No. The actual Sphere is the non-smoking venue. But yeah, for me, it's future in the sense that you're going to see, you know, obviously more of these being built, other people venturing into these types of more immersive venues. I think we're going to see different iterations, different flavors, right, of what this is going to become. That's very, very interesting to see how it all develops. My hope is that, and these venues are very expensive, obviously, to build and create. My hope is that it's also going to allow us to potentially have some of these more immersive experiences, maybe in the Vision Pro or Meta Quest 3, that we're going to be able to capture and live again once that residency is done, right?
That's exactly what I'm thinking. If they do that, then I think you've got a long, healthy future behind that building.
Yeah, so it's exciting. And that kind of leads us really well into our next one about Apple and AI, right? There's news from Bloomberg and different media talking about how Apple is playing catch up on AI, on generative AI specifically. And you've probably noticed this, Lee, like when you had, you know, the June 5th WWDC, which is their developers conference, and, you know, the last Apple event where they launched the new iPhone. They don't talk about artificial intelligence per se. They'll say machine learning. They'll talk about different words, the neural networks. So it's really interesting to read an article saying that they're playing catch up. Because to me personally, and I've always said this, they've always been playing with AI. They just haven't been saying AI every other word. And for me, their device, the Apple Vision Pro, is in essence part of their their AI play. Like, you cannot have spatial computing without AI. Like, in order for the world to be meshed and everything, there needs to be a lot of sensors. There needs to be computer vision. There needs to be AI scanning the room. So, as much as I feel like maybe the conversation is because it's generative AI and everything, I don't feel like they're necessarily playing so much catch up. They've already been in the game. They're working on a new Siri. Like, what are your thoughts around that? Because to me, it's like, I feel like we're not really thinking in the broader terms. We're just very focused on generative AI.
I think they are playing catch up in a way. The new iOS launched with this ability, and it's really hidden inside of your accessibilities of being able to voice print your voice so mm-hmm. that people who need that type of technology, and they saw it as a accessibility type tool, could have your voice kind of set into the phone to speak for you. It's neat. But it doesn't hold a candle to the type of things that like 11 Labs is doing right now. And 11 Labs is not a big company. They're not hefty backed. They're definitely not Apple. They're not even on the same planet as a behemoth like Apple. So in that sense, Apple's got to do a little bit of catch up because they just destroyed Siri on basically a GitHub repo. So there's a lot there to unpack if you think about it from that perspective.
Apple's already always working with R&D teams behind the scenes on something that we don't even know. Like
that's true, but I think they perfect. Is what they do. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like Apple doesn't really. I'm going to hate mail for this. Apple doesn't innovate. It doesn't.
Okay, I don't agree with you, but okay.
It doesn't innovate. Apple perfects, and it's more important.
Most true in some ways.
everything that we see come from Apple, it has been done at some level, not done as well. But it's been done. And it is even going all the way back to the iPod. We had MP3 players and they all sucked. And Apple perfected it with the iPod, right? We had smartphones. Apple perfected the smartphone.
The watch and the AirPods.
I know they didn't have the first watch because I worked on that first watch and they perfected it and ate our lunch. Like, that's just the way it is. When I say Apple doesn't innovate, that's not a bad thing. They perfect.
And that you could even say that about the Apple Vision Pro in some ways, right?
I absolutely can.
Meta's been working on it, especially, I worked at Magic Leap. They were meshing the world before Apple was meshing the world. But I do think they innovate. Like, I don't know. I never second guess them. Like, I feel like there's always these large teams working on something that we don't even know. I don't know.
And I believe that that's true too. And they can catch up faster than anyone because they can pay for the fastest shoes on the planet. So they'll get people up and running to bring this type of technology into it. But even when Apple Maps came out, it could not compete with Google Maps. And when you had things like the voice recognition for Siri versus the technology like Hey Google, when those two technologies kind of launched at the same time, Apple had a really hard time with accents. Now they overcame it and they perfected all of that. But Google had
a little bit better. Well, now with AI, we can all speak any language.
We can speak any language. And so it's one of these things where, am I worried about, is this a bad thing for Apple? No, it's never been a bad thing for Apple.
No.
They're gonna look at someone's homework and then figure out all the questions they got wrong. And then they're going to get those questions right. And get extra points.
So it's all good. All right. So future or fad? Like, to me, Apple's part of the AI future. There's no question about it.
Yeah, it would be foolish to bet against them in this. This is not even a hiccup. I read the article and they're like, oh, they got caught with their, I don't think they said they got caught with their pants down or anything like that, but it was something akin to that. And I was just like, no, that's overstating. It's this is very par for the course on how Apple rolls out technology from my experience with them. And I think that they're going to hit a home run. I'm not worried about it.
Not worried about it either. All right. So we're going to go on break. And then when we get back, I'm going to have an interview with my friend David Armano, who works for Soul Machines. We're going to be talking about AI. Which seems to be a topic we're talking a lot about during this podcast. We'll be talking about AI, but also David's perspectives on the future of work and when people tie their identity and their, you know, to their careers and to the employers that they have. He has some really interesting perspectives. When we get back from break, we'll have David Armano and then a special new section called Dispatch from the Fringe.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
David Armano, welcome to Tech Magic.
Good morning, Kathy. Thank you for having me. And by the way, the band music just started right on cue.
I can't hear it, so it's fine. Okay. But if we get some, you know, some extra sound in the background, that's totally fine. It'll just add to the, you know, to the flair of the interview. So I love it. So David, you and I have known each other for quite a while now. It's been a while. We're both Adobe insiders, yep. Part of a group of business people that are very connected to Adobe and some of the things that they're doing with their tech and their products. But other than knowing each other from Adobe Insiders, I want people to kind of know some of the things that you're doing. So just for way of background, for people to get to know you, that, you know, a lot of people do know you, but whoever doesn't that's listening to this, just give us a little bit of, you know, who is David Armano? What are you doing right now? And we'll get into it.
Okay. Well, I feel very fortunate that there's even interest to talk to me. I feel like at this point in my career, you know, it's not like I'm in my 30s talking about social media. So much time has passed. So I feel like it's an honor that there's even still interest in things that I'm doing. But I'm a combination of a couple different things at the core. I'm a marketing communications person. I'm very deeply involved. I always have been deeply involved in technology. My career path has followed every major innovation in technology since, gosh, when I moved to Chicago, which is my first from New York, which was my first mm-hmm. job in technology, it was when the World Wide Web was just starting. And there's always been a technology component to everything I've done. But at the core, I'm a strategist, I'm a marketer. And my foundation was built as a designer. And I still consider myself a sort of design thinker, at least, in terms of how I approach things.
Well, you're definitely a brilliant thinker. You and I have had really interesting conversations. And I absolutely love the content you post on LinkedIn. So that's one of the reasons I reached out to you. I was like, oh my gosh, we need to talk about a lot of these things. So let's get into it. Right now, you're actually working in AI technology, which is like the place to be. That's what everyone wants to talk about. What was your path to get there? Obviously, because it's a non-traditional path to get to where you are.
Yeah. I started, so it's been almost 2 years now. And when I started, this was significantly pre-generative AI days, right? So when I started, what caught my attention with Soul Machines, which is the company I currently work at now, it is essentially interactive AI avatars. at that point, the field that we were in, you know something about this field, conversational AI, there was AI aspects of it, but it is not the AI that we know today in terms of large language models. But what appealed to me was you could see the opportunity even back then that the way that we would interact with technology was sort of on the cusp of changing. And obviously things like voice assistants were in that same space, right? In this conversational AI space. The attraction for me was I sort of thought I was going back to my roots in a way with these CGI-based avatars. When I went to design school, my major was computer graphics, and CGI was one of the courses that I took. So I thought, oh, this is really interesting. I think AI is poised to transform the customer experience. This CGI AI avatar space is super interesting. And then the big AI large language model exploded in, what was it, December of 2022, right? On the cusp of 2023. And everything changed, including our business. Now the products do connect to large language models, obviously ChatGPT. But what I'm really excited about is that you can see how businesses will be creating their own large language models. They'll be training and using deep learning and machine learning on their own data sets. So we're in for some super interesting times.
It is a crazy time to be in AI. I mean, you chose, in a serendipitous way, you chose a great time to be in the industry. My friend Allie K. Miller always says that it's the best time to be in AI. So really, really exciting. So you mentioned that you are a designer, right? Your career, you started off as a designer. How much does that continue to influence what you do today?
I did. And I do think it influences it significantly. I think at the core, we all have to define what we design is, what we think design is. And I've always defined it as an act of intention. I now do a newsletter, and it's purposely named David by Design because that was doing two things. One, it was sort of giving a nod to, I'm going to go back to where I started in a lot of ways. But two, design as an intentional act, one of the sort of post-COVID things for me was to live my life more intentionally. I'm being way more selective in who comes close in my inner circle, in the kinds of things that I take on, the kinds of people I surround myself with, all the above. So in terms of where I started in design, I started as a visual designer, but I feel like I got two educations in design. One was in visual design and computer-aided design, but then in the first 6 years of my career, or first maybe 10 years of my career, I really learned the foundation of what is now called user experience design, or UX. And at the end of the day, I think UX design, which now more broadly is customer experience design, is solving problems, right? And being user or customer centric. And I try to do that, even though sometimes I'm more involved in the strategy aspect now. I think one distinction is I go back to my designer DNA in terms that I like to see the strategy through, because it's when the strategy is out in, when it's deployed, that you get your most valuable insights, so you can refine your strategy and refine your deployment. That could be a marketing campaign, that could be a product, that could be a technology. So that's how I would summarize that.
Well, in talking about that, when you're designing strategy, right? When you're thinking about designing strategy, what is your, I don't want you to give us a secret sauce, but like, what is one of the biggest piece of advice, or the most important piece of advice you're giving any company or brand as they think about AI and you're working with them to design that strategy and how to deploy, soul machines? So what is something, or maybe one piece of advice, or something that a lot of people get wrong? Something, just some tidbit that someone can walk away with.
It's been largely unchanged. There's a lot of lip service paid to into things like being user-centric, customer-centric, people-centric, whatever you want to call it. Whether you call yourself a strategist, a designer, a marketer even, you have to be audience, user, customer, whatever label you want to give them, you have to be that voice. Because at the end of the day, if your campaign, if your product, whatever it is not providing value to that person at the other end of your product or screen or whatever it is. So that's the key. And in the corporate world, whether you're at a startup, or a large organization, you're constantly navigating different disciplines, different stakeholders, different power structures, different hierarchies, and you have to advocate and push for those voices because that is how things become successful.
I love that. That's great. I want to kind of change gears a little bit, right? I want to talk a little bit about some of the content that you're putting out there, the things that you're talking about. That I love the AI conversation, you know, and everything, but you're also talking a lot about the future of work, right? And I think a lot of people right now are going through, you know, they've been impacted, right? By layoffs, by changes, by a lot of things that are happening right now in the workspace. But what can you share with us? What insight can you give us into how we'll be working in the future? Both from an AI perspective, definitely we can tackle that, but also in general, as you know, as careers change, as you know, the work environment changes. What are some of your perspectives on that?
Yeah. I think it's really good to reflect on COVID more broadly as a great accelerator. And it's accelerated many things. It's accelerated things like e-commerce, different business models that we use more of now. And it's really accelerated, I think, trends in the workplace that have been percolating for some time that are now sort of almost 10 years into the future, compressed into sort of 2 years. One of those macro trends is just the sense of, you know, what COVID did was really, I think, get people to grapple with what work meant to them in their lives, because it forced them to slow down. So you have a lot of people of different generations actually thinking about, one of the things I wrote about, Kathy, I know you read it, was sort of how I used to really intertwine my personal identity with they were one thing. And my personal identity was really built on the place that I was working. I myself was laid off during COVID. And that was a big, it was first time ever in my career. And so that changed how I looked at a lot of different things. And there were many other experiences that I had during COVID. I think we all went through our things during COVID.
Yeah.
So I think people are reevaluating their life priorities. Another macro trend is you have now four generations in the workplace. This is phenomenal. This is one of the reasons why the remote work conversation is super complex, because it is true. A lot of Gen Zers, if being in the workplace, if you're just starting coming in, you do get a lot of advantages, but you also have, I love the phrase geriatric millennials, right? Mm-hmm. So these are your older millennials. They have families. Now, a lot of them feel like they put their...
I'm an older millennial, so I guess I'm
you
part of
those. You would be a geriatric millennial, Kathy. I would love that.
I just call myself an older millennial. I'll go with that. But
yeah, but you have what's actually, I think, the biggest part of the workforce now. Many mm-hmm. have families, and many of those millennials now really want that flexibility. You know, they're not at that early stage of their career. So you have Gen Xers like myself, who the heck knows, but we're super adaptable. And then you have boomers who have always worked a certain way. And I think they're the ones really struggling with some of these dynamics. So it's super complex. And I think this is one of the reasons why employers are struggling, because there's not one single answer. You know, hybrid doesn't make anyone happy, but that's the definition of compromise.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's really interesting because there's this discontent, right? There's this tension right now happening. It's like, what is the right way to work, right? Yeah. And no one knows. Like, this is, especially mentioning all those, all those demographic groups in one place. And then, you know, as you look towards, you know, towards a couple of years, and you've got Gen Alpha coming in, that's like another added layer of complexity.
Yep.
I don't know. And like, then, have you given any thought to that?
Well, and then yes, and then throw AI into the mix, which I've been using the tools and spending a lot of also brain time. I think the people who talk about AI in terms of referencing sort of what's happened to the blue collar world over the past decades in terms of automation, they're the ones being honest. And so AI to the white collar world is what automation was, you know, mechanical automation was to the blue collar world. The United Auto Workers, who are on strike right now, by the way, there's another reason for that, economic conditions. But when you look at assembly lines, there are robots on those lines, but there's also people, and there's people working alongside robots. And that's the future for the white collar workforce as well. That does mean some jobs won't exist. That does mean you may need less writers. You may need less art directors. You may need less. I love it when CEOs say, oh, AI can replace my job too. I'm like, no, stop it. CEOs right now realize you said the word tension. They know that tension's in place. They want to be seen as one of the workers. So when you talk about Gen Alpha, these large language models, these AI jobs, they do entry-level job tasks very well. So we are entering a future where I think the entry-level job opportunities, there'll be less because it'll be more efficient because of AI.
And that in itself breeds discontent, right? Because you're already seeing in parts of the world like China where like youth unemployment is massive, right? And that just presents a whole problem in itself. What is your advice, right? And I kind of want to get back to kind of that future of work and like what people are going through right now. What is your advice as someone that went through a layoff? And I did too during COVID. It really impacted me. And I had tied my identity into the company I was working with. But what is your advice to the people, you know, that in our, you know, and across the industries that are getting laid off, especially those white collar workers, right? What is your advice to them right now? What can they do? What is a smart thing to do at this point?
Oh, that's a great question. It's interesting timing for that question because we've seen when there was the great resignation happening, all of a sudden so many employees in the white collar world had multiple job offers and all these opportunities. And now it is not like that. And so I think the you have to realize that your employer is always going to have leverage. But I think the thing to resist is employers like to use different kinds of things. We're family here, right? I know we've heard this. I know people have talked about it. But I do believe that really the true reality of work is that it is transactional. But when employees don't realize that and they buy into, well, this is my life and this is everything and this is my identity, when they buy into that, they actually, what they do is they make the value exchange lopsided. And so they're giving more to the employer than the employer is actually giving back because the employer will do whatever's right for the business. They will, look at spreadsheets and say, we need to actually clean off X amount of percent. So I think the single most effective thing that you can do if you're working for a company is do your job well and do the things that it takes to move ahead. But two things, one, divest your identity from it. And two, yes, do some things on the side. If you need to, that don't conflict with your work.
Your dog doesn't approve of that.
And my dog says he agrees. He's like, yes, that was translation for divest.
Well, that's part of like the new hybrid model. We're all working from home at times and everything. So it's part of the reality where we live in. I kind of want to, talk a little bit more from a personal perspective, like, what are some of the things that you're thinking about outside of tech and work that are adding magic to your life? Because at the end of the day, this is tech magic, and we've already talked tech, we've talked work. Like, what other things are adding magic to your life right now?
This is going to sound really, I don't know, basic. I mean, so you just heard one of them. We have two dogs, both rescues. Mm-hmm. What is one, the gift of dogs is that they are reminders of the important things in life. They are constantly, Kathy, you and I are immersed in technology. Okay. One of the biggest detriments of that is presence. If you're in the metaverse, I mean, we've actually been in the metaverse for the moment mobile entered our lives, right? Where like our attention is constantly in other places. Our mind is in other places. Dogs just live in the present. And so something that I've been doing that's been kind of magical, there was an article that talked about, I forgot the phrase that they use, like quiet walking. And I realized, I listen to podcasts during my walk. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to just not listen to anything when I walk anymore. And that sounds super straightforward and kind of obvious. It's been so helpful to just unwind that habit. I still like podcasts. I'll listen to them, but not when I'm walking my dogs. Yep, here comes the inspector. Perfect timing. Both dogs are going to be going crazy.
You're going to go on a quiet walk. Well, just to wrap up, where can people connect with you, find you? Where do you share your content? Just let people know where they can find you.
Yeah, davidarmano.me or LinkedIn.
Yeah, and then your newsletter?
David by Design. Correct.
All right, awesome. Well, we'll let you and your pups go on your quiet walk. Thanks for joining us for Tech Magic.
Thanks so much, Kathy.
All right, so that was a great interview with my friend David Armano from Soul Machines about the work they're doing in AI, but also his perspectives on the future of work. And Lily, I know you have done work with Soul Machines. You're a certified AI writer, conversationalist. What is it, Lily?
A certified digital conversationalist.
Amazing. And Lily, who is joining us today, is our producer, our extraordinaire here at Tech Magic. She's joining us for a new segment we're launching called Dispatch from the Fringe. Very excited about this new section. Lee, are you excited about it too?
Considering Lily's one of my favorite people, yes, it doesn't even matter what the segment's about. I'm just glad Lily's on. That's enough for me.
Fantastic. So, Lily, what do you have for us from the Fringe? What is one of the weirdest stories you've seen in the tech space?
All right. Well, in the spirit of Halloween, I had to pull up this story about scientists who modified silkworms to produce bionic spider silk. So in this story, researchers used CRISPR gene editing to produce super strong spider silk fibers from common silkworms. And this is a revelation because silkworms are the only animal protein fiber commercially produced on a large scale because they have low production cost. But the problem is their silk is restricted in industries like the textile industry because of its limited mechanical performance. So spider silk is much stronger, and using this gene editing, the spider silk fibers have a higher tensile strength than nylon, and they surpass Kevlar's toughness sixfold. So in an article from Technology Networks about this research, they say that, quote, these findings could help pave the way for spider silk's commercialization, ending the current reliance on less sustainable synthetic fibers.
That's awesome, Lily. And this is kind of like, this is like a Spider-Man kind of situation, right?
Yes, I'm pretty sure this is what he uses. So why it's important again is the sustainability around it. So right now around 60% of clothing is made from synthetic fiber. So this way, the bionic spider silk can reduce those efforts in clothing and fast fashion. And this type of spider silk can even be used for like surgeons creating stronger and better sutures. That's my dispatch from the Fringe.
All right, Lily. Well, thank you so much. That was really, really interesting and perfect, perfect timing for Halloween. And on that note, Lee, what are you going to dress up as? Are you a Halloween fan?
I'm a huge Halloween fan, but I only have one costume, and I know you can guess the costume.
I don't know. Are you dressing up?
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I think I know. I know one of your favorite movies is Back to the Future, too.
Yep, it is. It is. 100%. Yes, I have.
So are you going to be Doc, or are you going to be Marty McFly?
Great. It's Einstein, the dog. No, I'm going. No, I'm kidding. No, I'm going to do Marty McFly every time.
I love that. So do you have like lace-ups, like Nikes, like automatic lace-up Nikes?
I got the next best thing. I got a pair of, they did this like limited run at Nike of like LeBron James high tops as his basketball shoe. And they look a lot like the Nike mags, and they're in the same color and all of that. So I use those. I don't have the auto laces that they released a couple of years ago, because those are like $80,000, and no, so I don't have them.
I love that. What about Beanie? Does your dog get a costume too?
Beanie always gets a costume. Last year, Beanie went as the most adorable Dima dog from Stranger Things you've ever seen. And then this year, she's this cute white little fluff ball of a dog. And we're just going to put, and her name's Beanie. And so we're just putting the heart tie toy tag from Beanie Babies on her collar. And she's just going as a Beanie Baby.
I love that.
We got better. We have better costumes for our dog than we do for ourselves. Hands down. We're just like way more creative when it comes to our pets.
That's awesome. Well, I'm going to be a zombie cheerleader. Not by choice. I just happen to be chaperoning a dance at my kid's school, which is a fundraiser for the cheer team. So I had no vote or say on this zombie cheerleader costume, but that's what I'm going to be. My kids are all dressing up and, you know, things that they like. And I'm also going to be taking my son to watch the new Five Nights at Freddy's
movie.
So very excited. I know there's a lot of people in the gaming industry excited about it. I've been kind of diving deep into the lore of this indie video game turned movie that's coming, Five Nights at Freddy's and all that. So very thrilled about that. Are you going to go see that at all?
We'll see. I'm going to see. I want to see what the reviews come back on. I'm not a big Five Nights at Freddy's fan. It's not been my game. I know it's a hot trend. It's as hot as any, I don't know. Horror? Is it a horror trend? I don't know if I consider it. It's
PG-13 horror. So like they're doing some interesting work with like shadow work for some of the scenes that are like not. Yeah. But I will tell you this, like my kids, like the eighth grade chat and the sixth grade chat, they're all talking about FNAF. It's like they're talking about the dance, FNAF.
It's popular. Yeah. It is the trend. I want to know what you think after you see it. Tell me.
Okay. We'll talk in our next Tech Magic. So just want to say thank you to our producer, Lily, for joining us for Dispatch from the Fringe. And Lee, thanks for joining me as co-host. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Tech Magic. We hope you will subscribe and review our podcast. We are thrilled with how much people are loving the podcast and the feedback we're getting. Send us an email. Send us comments. Let us know what you want us to talk about, what we can, you know, what topics we can talk about. And if you come across any interesting, you know, weird technology stories, we'd love to hear about those as well. Thank you, Lily.
And if I said something to make an Apple fanboy angry in the previous segment, it's junk at Tech Magic.
And on that note, thank you so much, everyone. We'll see you next week for more Tech Magic.
Hey there, podcast fam. Are you ready to break free from the social media rut? Hold on to your hats because we've got just the thing for you. Meet Viral Growth, your one-stop shop for leveling up your online presence. Whether you're a personal brand or a company, they've got the tools and know-how to take you to the next level. With Viral Growth, forget about those endless hours of video editing. They handle everything from brainstorming to polishing your content so you can just focus on being awesome. And guess what? We're hooking you up with a sweet deal. Use code ADWEEK for 10% off when you sign up. Ready to take your social media game to the next level? Head on over to viralgrowth.io and let's turn those digital dreams into a reality.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.